Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today, on this, the very first day of the month of April 2017, I'm delighted to welcome to the programme Campbell Adams for a discussion on a subject that I think is likely to be new to most people, but which does in fact go back a long way in history, and which I think is going to lead to a very interesting conversation. And that is the subject of yarndling, which we'll get into in just a moment. Campbell Adams was for many years president of the Ancient Order of Yarndlers in Wolberswick. I presume I've pronounced that correctly.
Yes.
Suffolk, where he lives with his common law wife and their 12 hairless cats. He has written many books over the years, such as Looking Through Binoculars at Yarndling, 1987, Yarndling in High Places, 1995, and the quite controversial book I Was Forced to Yarndle in 2005. He has lectured on yarndling in schools and colleges across the UK and is currently researching for his latest book, Never Too Old to Sing the Yarndling Blues, an overview of yarndling folk songs from medieval times up till 1967. Campbell Adams, thank you very much for joining us on The Mind Renewed.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Julian. Thank you.
That's great to be speaking with you. I mean, I'm very glad that you have agreed, because this is a subject that I've been wanting to discuss on the show since really a listener kindly suggested it to me a few months ago. But it is really quite difficult to find out information about this subject in spite of its popularity at different times and places. I guess because it's so, well, it is quite secretive anyway. So it's great to have you on the show to pick your brains about the subject. So this is going to be about yarndling, the art of yarndling, or the craft, the game, the trade. Some people say the discipline. It's really quite difficult to define it. But before we get into all of that, let's start with you, Campbell. How did you first get into this business of yarndling?
That's a good question, really. I think the answer to that is, how could I not get into yarndling, if you like? You see, my great-great-grandfather, Hamlet Kinsey, was a founder member of the West Wickham branch of the Brotherhood of Yarndlers. That would have been about the 1880s, 1890s, I think. Sadly, his diaries were all destroyed in a flood we had back in the early 60s. So I can't be more specific, and there is some sort of gaps in the information there. But he was what they called a head disciplinarian, which to us today sounds very severe. But really, it was all about making sure that all the various practitioners of the craft, and it does tend to be called a craft these days, although when you look back through history, some people would have done it as a hobby, perhaps some would have done it as an art, but I suppose yarndlers would think of themselves as craftsmen, craftspeople. So my great-great-grandfather would make sure the people were subject to the same ancient rule of the yarndler's code as they should be. And I suppose this mainly applied to good housekeeping, to upholding the social aspects, keeping your chawns and horned spinnakers in good condition.
Right. You mentioned that he was the head disciplinarian of the West Wickham branch. So that suggests that there were other disciplinarians who were lower than him. So were there other people with that title?
There were two others. And it sounds very strange to us now, but the slang for them was shoulders, because he was effectively the head, and the two people who were slightly lower than him were considered the shoulders, or were they referred to sometimes as the shoulders.
So the, right, I know, so it's like the head and shoulders.
Exactly. It's very strange. He was the head for a good sort of 20 or 30 years, I think.
And it was the Brotherhood of Yarndlers. You know, immediately I think of, you know, things like the Freemasons, semi-secret societies like that, Skull and Bones at Yale University. So was it similar to that? Was it something a bit mysterious about it?
No, it was never, there was never anything occultic, if you like, about the society. It was always based around the traditional craft, which essentially comes from nature. So it was a sort of a nature-based organization, not secretive, but at the same time, if you weren't, for instance, you know, a member of the family or the son of a yarndler, etc., that you would perhaps, you wouldn't really know what the whole thing was about. So it was very much a generational craft, but not secretive in the sense that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you keep mentioning it as a craft, but that's not to pin it down, is it? Because there is still some ambiguity as to quite what's involved.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think yarndlers, if you spoke to a yarndler today, he would refer to it as a craft. In certain times in history, it's been performed as a hobby. again, some people will refer to it as an art, but if you're actually, if it's your sort of livelihood, you are a craftsman. Right. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
All right, I get the picture. And you mentioned horned spinnakers and chorns. I mean, chorns we're going to talk about quite a lot later because they're extremely important to the whole business of yarndling. Now, I think of a spinnaker as a kind of sail, but that's not true with yarndling, is it? The horned spinnaker, anyway.
No. The word is the same, but the horn spinnaker is essentially made of, almost always made of goat's horn, and then it's overlaid with an oyster veneer. And essentially, in yarndling, a spinnaker would be used as a counterbalance.
And that's essential to the good or bad functioning of yarndling?
Yeah. I mean, you can yarndle without one, but you won't get very far.
Okay. Well, you have very kindly supplied me with a couple of audio recordings of good and bad yarndling involving the appropriate or inappropriate use of the horn spinnaker. So we're going to listen to a couple of examples here to give people an idea. So first of all, we're going to hear an example of good yarndling. Okay, so that was an example there of good yarndling. We go to hear the example now of bad yarndling. I think perhaps we'll hear those again because they're very short. So first of all, I'm going to play the good yarndling and then, by way of contrast, the bad yarndling. So good first, then bad. Here we go. Okay, so we've heard those two examples. Very interesting. Thank you for sending me those. Now, it does involve the correct and then the incorrect use of the spinnaker, the horn spinnaker. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, the horn spinnaker, as I say, is used as a counterbalance. But what you've also got in the example of bad yardling is that the left-handed chuck, and you can sort of hear it the second time, perhaps more than the first, is not fully engaged. So the tempo is all wrong. I mean, it's as straightforward as that. And if you listen to it, you can pick up the difference the more you listen to it.
And there seemed to be a difference in the sort of metallic, boxy sound. Every now and again, there was a thud, a kind of boxy, metallic sound, which was more obvious in the good example than the bad.
Mm. Which is odd, isn't it? Because although it sounds almost machine-like, it isn't, and it can't possibly be performed, you know, without a yarndler performing it. So the irony is that the more machine-like it sounds, the more it's actually created by a person, and in fact the bad yarndling is an example of that the other way around.
Okay, well, your great-great-grandfather, as an expert practitioner in this, would have done good yarndling, I'm quite sure. And you have a picture of him. On the picture that you sent me that I show on the website, you're actually holding a photograph of him. Could you tell us a little bit more about him?
Yeah, well, we don't, as I say, because of essentially all the diaries were destroyed in this flood, there's not a great deal we know about him, other than that he was this, as I say, a disciplinarian. Then after he died, my great-grandfather wasn't such a dedicated practitioner at all, but both my grandmother and grandfather were very keen on revisiting these old customs. So in fact, as you probably know, during the 1930s, especially in Great Britain, there was a huge resurgence in yarndling, I mean, across all the social classes. To give you some context, we'd just come out of a war that was supposed to have ended all war, but there was still this whiff of fear, if you like, in the air, I mean, because of what was happening in Germany and Europe. And I think people knew that the rise of National Socialism would prove an even bigger threat. And so basically people, certainly in this country, wanted to be reminded of the old ways, in inverted commas, to draw themselves back into their own history. Although, of course, as we'll probably talk about, that history began in Albania, of all places.
Yeah, that was quite a shock, actually, to hear that. You say there was a resurgence of yarndling in the 1930s, therefore it seems very odd that there's so little information available about it. I mean, when you search on the internet using your favourite search engine, you find very little. Why is that?
Well, of course, information is only as good as the source material. And a lot of the time, even, this sounds very bizarre now, even in the 1930s, it was still an oral tradition. So any of the written material is still quite hard to come by, and it's a process of constant research, which is, you know, what I and fellow Yandel experts have been looking into. So it's a good question, but it sort of goes to show, if you like, we're so used to the world of the internet and Googling things, but sometimes it's actually not as easy as that.
Right. And in a funny way, that's strangely reassuring, in the sense that it's nice to know that you can't always find out everything on the internet that easily. Okay, so let's return to your family's history, because you've told us a fair bit about that, but I know there's more that you want to share with us. So please do.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that my grandparents both got married in the Mornington Crescent branch of the Society of Camden Town Yardlers. Now, that was something that you were allowed to do in those days. So the chief threader of the society was also an ordained minister. I think that was in 1939. But it was a big thing back in those days, as I said, and I grew up essentially in an atmosphere very conducive to yarndling. I remember that my father would often take me out on walks in the countryside, point out various shrubs and things that would have been smoked in the yarndler's old clay pipes. And in fact, you can still find these distinctive clay pipes with the inverted tenon and mortise joints, if you know where to look.
Oh, wow, you can still find them. Have you ever found one yourself?
Not as a child, but oddly enough, I did find one last year sort of washed up on the tide, and it's a very good example.
Wow. Where would be the best places to find them, would you reckon?
The best places, I suppose, are rivers, at the mouth of a river, because that's essentially, not always, but certainly on the south coast, was where yarndling was performed more than other places. So if you're looking, walking along the beach, especially if it's a shingly beach, and you're sort of looking for these very small white clay pipes.
Wow. Well, there we are. There is a challenge for listeners to the Mind Renewed to go and see if you can find a yarndler's pipe. Now, you mentioned, as I say, it's quite a surprise to me, but you did mention that yarndling had its beginnings in Albania, of all places. Could you tell us a bit more about that beginning?
Yeah, and I think before I do, I think it's fair to say that yarndling experts do disagree on this.
Okay.
But for my money, you do need to go back to the early medieval period in that country to find the very first mentions of the craft. In the 9th century, you've got these proto-Albanians that were still a disparate collection of itinerant herdsmen, if you like. And there is a reference there to something called, now I'm probably not pronouncing this right, Tebefte Miri, which loosely translates as place of the glove makers. Now, as you know, gloves, and specifically the ones made from, weaved from beaver skin, are very important to the true yarndler. So
the chorns, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
I mean, nowadays, the Albanian beaver is a protected species, but not then, of course. So these gloves, as you say, they are usually called chorns, and they're key to the whole yarndling lifestyle, if you like. Mm. And there's a very important document that refers to them. There are also references to a specific kind of hat with a tufted brim and tassels made of otter tail, which are certainly something that used to be associated with yarndling. And then as the decades... go on.
Yeah, so this, again, I don't know whether I pronounce it correctly, but based upon what you said, Tebefte Miri,
yeah,
which you say means something loosely like place of the glove makers, that's mentioned in the document. Now, when you sent me the email about it, the Bulgarian Codicil document?
Yes, that's right.
Right, okay. Now, this predates the Doomsday Book?
It does, actually. It predates it by a good 150 years or so. Mm. The Bulgarian Codicil is a tiny fragment of parchment, which I think, and I don't quote me on this, I think it is actually currently held in the Musée d'Orsay in Paris. Certainly that's where I saw it a few years ago. So that's a very important document, if you like, to yarndling experts.
And it's a codicil, so it's like an additional piece of writing to a will or something like that?
Well, nowadays, yeah, it's got a very sort of strict legal terminology relating to a will, but it does actually just mean, as you say, an additional or a supplemental piece of information that explains something in a more loose sense.
Mm-hmm. So I brought up the Doomsday Book because you tell me yarndling is mentioned in that famous historic document, the Doomsday Book. We're talking about the late 1000s, the late 11th century. So we have this movement of the practice of yarndling from Albania to England in a period of roughly 150 years or so, which seems, I mean, how come it travelled all the way to England from Albania in what at least seems to me to be a relatively short period of time?
I suppose that's essentially because of the beaver trade. There became certainly a shortage of beavers in Albania. So some of the herdsmen would go further afield. They'd go up towards the Balkans, etc. And gradually, over a period of 150 years, they would make their way on small rafts to other countries, including Britain. Mm-hmm. So it's as simple as that.
Okay. And there's mention of Yandlers in Lancashire, you say, in the Domesday Book.
Yes. Yes, that's right. I know, because I know that's where you're based, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. I mean, you've got references to falconers, millers, rat catchers, and Yandlers, mainly in places like Cumbria and North Yorkshire. And there's one, I think, okay, if I can find it, there is, I've got it in front of me here. There's a reference in the Domesday Book to a band of hardy men with peaked hats and solid stools who were based in a small hamlet near Clitheroe. So these were very much part of the community. And the solid stools in this case refers to the ancient Yandler stools, which were originally made from a solid block of holly or hornbeam.
And the Yandler's chair gets a mention in us. And we're going to be listening to a folk song in a short while. So that says the Yandler's chair. Is that the same as the stool?
It's similar. I mean, a chair obviously has got four legs. A Yandler stool has got three legs. The thing about the Yandler's stool is that the third leg would have a beveled edge, enabling rotation if necessary.
Well, maybe this would be a good time to clarify some of the terminology surrounding Yandling. Obviously, we have a stool, chair, we know what those things are. Mm. But we need to understand about chorns. We've said something about them. And, of course, the term Yandling itself. So let's start there. The word to Yandle. Where did that come from?
Well, again, it's similar to essentially where the craft came from. There are various viewpoints, but most people, I think now the consensus of opinion is that the word Yandling derives from the Old Norse word Yenadal. Again, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, who does? But that itself is a corruption of Yern Ladedalia, which is a phrase in everyday use among the, even up now, the agricultural labourers of Cumbria, going right back to the first century AD. I mean, another theory, to be honest, it doesn't hold so much sway now, but there are some folks who believe it, is that back in medieval times, people sometimes combined water divining with wet nursing. And this led to the portmanteau word Yundarling. Now, over the centuries, this was corrupted and shortened to Yandling. I mean, I don't know if there's much in it because, well, as you and I know, Yandling is one of the driest crafts you can perform.
I have to say, it doesn't sound particularly plausible to me. I have to agree with you.
No,
And it's interesting, this etymological question here, because some people say, as you have done, that the Old Norse came first with Yenadal, and then the Old Cumbrian dialect, Yen le Dadela. But there are others who say it was the other way around, that it was the Cumbric first, and then that somehow migrated into the Norse tongue.
I personally like to think that the Cumbrian came first. But I mean, the whole world of the Yandling community is a broad church, if you like. So people do have different opinions about that. But I think, again, it's a subject for more research.
Well, let's turn then to a researcher, Dr. Chris Tavistock of New College, Cambridge, because he has quite a lot to say on this matter, and he is a historian and fellow of that college. He's an expert on Yandling history, perhaps indeed a world authority on chorns, and I know that you were fortunate enough to interview him recently, and we've got the recording. So let's hear what he has to say about the etymology of the word Yandling.
There's not much hard evidence on the early distribution of Yandling. References in the ancient literatures are particularly few. There is a widespread assumption that the word Yandling comes from Old Norse. I have to acknowledge this is not my particular field of expertise, but I would like to see more research into the possible Celtic roots of the term, because the Vikings were travelling widely, not always in violent raiding, but also for purposes of commerce. I think their connections with northwest England, with Cumbria, and with Ireland also, and the Vikings were very much present in the Irish Sea, connections possibly with Wales also. I think the term may have entered Old Norse from one of the Celtic languages. There was definite evidence from after the Dark Ages of a Yandling industry in Brittany. There's that strong cultural and ethnic connection between Brittany and Cornwall, the ancient Britons along with the Welsh. I do think maybe the very word itself does have origins in the British Isles through Celtic languages and their decline later has made us unaware of that derivation.
Okay, so that was Dr. Chris Tavistock going there from his research with the theory that the word starts off with Celtic origins and then progresses into the Norse tongue. So, well, that's his field. So let's move on to the subject of chorns, because, as we've already said, they're central to this whole business of yarndling, and I don't think we're going to get very far with our conversation if we don't actually know something about them. So do tell us about chorns, what they are, and perhaps something about the word?
Yeah, sure. Well, obviously, we've established that they're gloves. Now, these are special gloves yarndlers wear. And as I think we've already said, they come from beaver. Sometimes when beaver was in short supply, they would make them out of weasel or mink, and they'd be skinted, which I think we'll talk about, won't we?
Yes.
So the ancient Celtic name for beaver was Shorn, S-H-O-R-N. And then the Cumbrian dialect hardened the sh sound to a chirp, which is a classic example of consonantal shift. So they became, from shorns, they became chorns. There is a well-known 18th century anonymous tract called Cumbrian Elegies, which goes, again, I do apologize for the accent, which goes, I yarndled o'er ill and don't dale, with nought but a chorn in one hand and a pie in t'other. So again, apologies for the accent, but that's one of the pretty much one of the earliest examples, or it's a classic example of chorns anyway.
All right, so a chorn in one hand and a pie in the other. So
yes.
It's not just any old pie, it's a yarndless pie, is that right?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, these were eaten mainly just by yarndlers, yeah. They would vary according to the region. What was essential was that would always be a basic ingredient of leeks. It's odd, isn't it? No matter which part of the country, no matter how plentiful leeks were or not, then they were still an essential ingredient.
So the type of meat wasn't essential to that.
No.
But I think you told me that cattle were often reared specially for this and kept separate from other livestock.
Yes, I think it depends on how strict you were being, but essentially that was the case, that there would be certain areas of the farm, of the field, that were segregated for yarndlers' cattle. Yeah. Mm.
Is that still the case today, or is it just any old meat used these days?
No, it tends to be any old meat. There's a lot of interbreeding goes on in the cattle, so you don't really have that same segregation of cattle that you certainly used to back, certainly in the 18th century. It was very common. I mean, it was interesting because, obviously, for a farmer to have that, it would be more expensive business keeping these cattle separate.
Yeah.
But it was so important to the craft that they kept these old traditions, and sadly nowadays it's not so important.
Right, but you can't just buy a yarndless pie in the supermarket, can you? You still have to go
No,
specialist shops, I guess, is it?
Yeah, if you can find them, they're quite hard to find these days, but yeah, specialist shops.
Mm. Well, I guess I'm distracted by the idea of the pie because I'm feeling a bit hungry now, but I don't actually want to get away from this whole business of chorns because I think there's more to be said. We're going to listen again to some words from Dr. Tavistock, this time while speaking about several things, really, first of all, the importance of yarndling for the British economy. I think it was very interesting you got that information out of him. So the British economy involved Canada at the time, and indeed the French and Portuguese economies. But he also talks about the crucial role played by chorns in the ups and downs of that yarndling history over the centuries. And indeed the way chorns did, in fact, change in design to some extent. So let's hear a few words again from Dr. Chris Tavistock.
The extent to which yarndling was an important sector of the British economy is difficult to pin down, given the lack of hard statistical evidence. I mean, that's common for many, even important industries. And by the time we have the census of production introduced by the new liberals in the early 20th century, of course, yarndling had been in decline for well over a century and barely features as an important component. But that shouldn't blind us to the fact that many communities relied on yarndling to a very great extent in previous centuries. Our evidence, admittedly, is fragmentary and very localized in parish records, and it seems fairly safe to assume that during the Middle Ages, the scale of the trade was very limited because of the shortage of chorns. It's hard to yarndle without a good pair of chorns, and they were a big investment, and the necessary beaver pelts were in short supply for a very long period. This did lead to the skintering trade becoming an important political issue in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. As I say, Yarndling had been held back through the shortage of chawns. There therefore was a great built-up pressure on international trade to provide more beaver pelts for skintering. But there was also a great deal of competition. We tend to think nowadays of Yarndling as a characteristically British activity, but in past times there was considerable interest in the craft, certainly along the western seaboard of Europe. You know, and the Portuguese had taken their place quite prominently in the 13th, 14th centuries. Later, the French were coming to the fore, and this did lead to chawns becoming a factor in the mercantile contest between France and England in the 17th and 18th centuries. It's become increasingly apparent through study of the French documentary records, which strangely are a rather better source than the English in the 17th century, certainly, that the quest for suitable pelts was driving forward French colonisation, really, from the first settlement at Tadoussac in 1600. This is in Canada, in Les Pays d'Arnaud, north of Montreal. And later in the century, well, there was a real risk of conflict between the French and the Hudson Bay Company, that obtaining an adequate supply of materials for skintering was possibly a factor in the King's grant of the charter of the Hudson Bay Company in 1670. In the course of the 18th century, the emergence of British supremacy in Upper Canada did lead to this problem being resolved, and that is when, thanks to the greater supply of chawns, Yarndling really became a particular British strength in economic terms, and the French really fell behind, and the French Yarndling industry ceased to be of much importance. Having emphasised the importance of the Canada trade for beaver pelts, which were not only being used for hats, that's what people tend to remember from, you know, beaver hats from the 17th century, but also being used for chawns, it's worth emphasising that this did have an impact on the geographical distribution of Yarndling. Admittedly, once a skilled Yarndler had his chawns, he always took great care of them, and they could last a lifetime if properly oiled and stored in good conditions without damp and so forth. There was a danger of mould, but you know, given their importance to the process, they were always taken care of and were treated as great family heirlooms. So it was a significant moment in the intergenerational movement of a family when the old generation, perhaps it would be a grandfather, handed over his chawns to his grandson so he could join the intervening generation in the trade. But the point I was making, sorry, is that the geographical distribution of Yarndling did to some extent reflect the North Atlantic trade, so one finds it essentially on the west coast in the 17th and early 18th century, until after the Seven Years' War, when English supremacy, I should say British supremacy, is established in Canada, when the supply of beaver pelts for skintering becomes much more plentiful, which then allows skintering and, by implication, Yarndling to take place more widely across England, and we then have the beginnings of the strong Suffolk tradition. Also, that greater availability of the raw materials for skintering did lead to developments in the design of chawns. That indeed does seem to have started in the Suffolk area. Admittedly, the evidence for this is not strong, just from surviving pairs of chawns, which can be seen in the local museums in that area. But you then do see the greater popularity of the bifurcated chawn, This does require, of course, more leather. So it was only when the price of beaver pelts had become significantly lower that the skinterers were able to produce the more material-intensive bifurcated chawn at a price which ordinary yarndlers could afford.
It's amazing how much history there is that we very rarely get to hear about, or perhaps never get to hear about, so it's great to hear Dr. Tavistock tell us about these things. And what's very clear from what he has to say there is that chawns really did play a crucial role in the whole history of yarndling. As he says, if you haven't got a good pair of chawns, it's very difficult to yarndle. Almost no chawns, no yarndling, you know.
Yeah.
So another thing he said is that the whole trading scene relating to chawns was fiercely competitive at many times. And that brings me to ask you about another form of competitiveness to do with yarndling, which is known as competitive threading. Mm-hmm. Now, in 2012, we did in fact hear that the Team GB at the Olympics sometimes referred to their determination to win as being, let me quote, in the spirit of yarndling. So that has to do mm-hmm. with fair play and equality for all and competitive threading, so they said. Mm-hmm. So two things here, really. You'll have to tell us what competitive threading is. And, you know, has that always been a feature of the yarndling world?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Julian. I mean, that was fascinating back in 2012 that they mentioned that. Competitive threading was a key ingredient of yarndling going right back to the early days. Not only were festivals held in major towns and cities, competitions were organised over a period of several days. And they also differed. They had different heats according to the thickness of the threads, but also whether they were bifurcated or not, which is interesting because, as Chris Tavistock mentioned, that you had the bifurcated chawns. So that's also reflected in the threads. Mm. Now, usually the further north you went, the thicker the threads, and therefore the slower it took to weave them onto your horizontal nap. So when you came down south to Dorset and Wessex, then the threads were very fine, almost silky. I think it used to be said that Wareham in Dorset held the silkiest threads.
Right, Wareham, interesting. I'll come back to that in a minute, because it's very close to where I grew up.
Oh, right.
Yeah, indeed. You mentioned bifurcation, so bifurcated chawns, which Chris Tavistock talked about, but bifurcated threads as well. Now, this whole business of bifurcation, that's actually a later development, isn't it? That doesn't go back to the early days in Albania, does it?
Oh, no. It's a much more recent thing. Yeah, I mean, the evolution of the chawns essentially is unchanged, apart from a sort of a moment in the, I think it was the 18th century, mid-18th century, when there was this sort of almost an explosion in bifurcated chawns. There was this sort of big offshoot and people experimented. That's where it all started. It's a very late development. Very interesting to have such a sudden change in essentially a craft that has remained fairly unchanged over the centuries. Yeah. So that's where the whole thing came from. And then, of course, the threads followed as well.
Yeah, and that was around the same sort of time that you had experimentation with a different type of nap, because you talk about the horizontal nap.
Yeah.
But around that time, somebody introduced the vertical nap, but that wasn't successful, was it?
No, I mean, the nap is this flat grooved plate for locating the porters on. But the vertical naps, they were tried briefly. It was a sort of a experimental craze, if you like. So they were tried, they were experimented with briefly. They proved disastrous.
Well, let's go back to Wareham. As I say, that's very close to Swanage, where I grew up.
Oh, right. Okay.
And there's a further Dorset yarndling connection with respect to the Tolpuddle Martyrs. I now know from the notes that you sent me. Mm. And I believe it's only in recent years that historians, most notably, of course, Chris Tavistock himself, have uncovered a taxation issue with yarndling that played at least some part in inspiring the Tolpuddle Martyrs to take the action that they did. Tell us about that. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Well, we don't know how much of an impact it had, to be honest. I will be clear about that. But it certainly had some. Now, I don't know how much you know, all your listeners will know about the Tolpuddle Martyrs. They were six men in 1833 in place called Tolpuddle in Dorset, and they founded the Friendly Society of Agricultural Labourers. Essentially, they were standing up for fair wages, and they were protesting against the wages being paid by the very rich landowners, and they were getting very little of the money. So one of the martyrs, James Brine, was the son of the president of the Tolpuddle Yarndling Fraternity. Now, his father had been pilloried the year before, and I mean literally pilloried. He'd been put into stocks and pelted with, you know, vegetables, which sort of is actually not very pleasant. I mean, it's sort of seen as a joke, but it actually was, you know, he was there for several days, I think.
Pretty horrendous, yeah.
Yeah. So he was protesting against this tax. Now, this tax was on yarndling equipment, specifically, in this case, chawns and tufted hats. So although yarndling as a craft wasn't taxed, the equipment necessary to perform it was. Right. So Obadiah Brine, that was his name, he considered this a huge social injustice. So although he himself took no part in the formation of the Tollbottle Martyrs, it was his son who stood up for what his father believed. And that was, in fact, one of the main reasons that James joined this, you know, incredibly risky venture. Then this is a side that's only just sort of coming out because of the research. Now, the positive side of this was that although the martyrs may have failed in the short term, you know, because they were transported to Australia, Brine, in fact, managed to set up a small yarndling community in Hobart, Tasmania. And I believe it's still running today. In fact, I am visiting Australia in a week's time, and I do hope to pay a visit there because I'd be very interested to see if it is how well it's going.
Yeah, it's fascinating, actually, that you should mention this because, believe it or not, I did actually hear about this from an alternative source. Listeners will know we had Garth Kennedy from Lightflint Radio on a few months back, and he had recently visited Tasmania on holiday, you know, and off-air he did mention that there is a small yarndling community out there, as you say, so that's very interesting indeed.
That is excellent to hear. Excellent.
Yeah, so I have to ask about this business again with the Tollbottle Martyrs. You say that the tax was not upon yarndling itself, but was upon the accoutrements. So we have the chawns and the tufted hats, and of course it invites me to say, is it not the case that the very fact that those items were taxed is evidence in itself that yarndling was, at the time, a significant part of the country's life?
Well, obviously. I mean, things are only taxed when the government thinks they can get money from them. Yes, that does show extent of it. I mean, I did mention, you know, chawns and the tufted hats, also jennies, floating jennies and static jennies.
Mm. So we have yarndling going all over the place, don't we? We have it going from Albania to Northern Europe and then right down to Tasmania. And
I know.
I think actually it would be good to hear a little bit more from Dr. Tavistock because he has quite a bit to say about this as well. And he told you in the interview that you had with him about the spread of yarndling across the British Empire. So let's hear what he had to say about that.
Yarndling was never a factor in Indian trade and climatic conditions didn't encourage it. But there is an imperial aspect also in that actual yarndling was introduced into Australia, Tasmania to be precise, at quite an early date. The famous, well, famous in yarndling circles, James Bryan, introduced it and set up his own chapter, I think it was one of the Eastern Counties Yarndlers Guilds, in Hobart, Tasmania, in the early years of the 19th century. So Australia has a long yarndling tradition. It has tended to be forgotten in Canada, since they only supplied the raw materials and were often not aware, I think, of the purpose to which they were put. There was a branch of the guild in New Zealand briefly in the 19th century. I mean, it seems incredible they should have been attempting to set up this industry given the very small local demand. But even at the time of the Maori Wars in the 1840s and 1850s, we have from that period some letters from William Stearns, I think the name was. He, in fact, had acquired his skills in Tasmania, but was an early settler in New Zealand. But it never really took hold there, and I think the guild had a very small membership. But I believe the Tasmanian guild from which it sprang is still in existence today, although I think it's to some extent turned into a social organisation. There was an attempt to establish yarndling in the Falkland Islands, but I think the distances involved in shipping really made it an unviable proposition. The Earl of Sunderland invested a lot of money very unwisely in attempting to establish the business there. He could afford it, of course, but I think some of the people he recruited from Cumbria and sent to the Falklands to introduce the skills and to train yarndlers, he pretty much abandoned them, unfortunately. But they were able to take work as shepherds. But for a skilled yarndler, that really was something of a come-down. But these were not men of independent means who could easily afford to return to England. One of them did, in later life, and tried to take legal action against the Earl. But in the 18th century courts, there was very little chance of that succeeding.
Well, having talked about the Tolpuddle martyrs a few minutes ago and that new piece of history uncovered by academics, I understand Yardling is associated with several other well-known historical events, again, that we didn't know much about until relatively recently. Wasn't there a connection with the Ramblers' School in Blandford? Of course, this takes us back to Dorset again.
That's right. Dorset does seem to feature quite prominently, doesn't it? Mm. Yeah, there was a Yardling Club at the Ramblers' School in Blandford Forum back in the early 20s. Now, what happened there was that they helped to uncover the world-famous chalk fole, which was near Winterbourne Thomas. And that probably would never have happened, which would have been a great shame because it's such a beautiful sight. Also, and again, sort of coincidentally staying in Dorset, you've got the Great Fire of Swanage in 1976. Now, this was as a result of, it was a loose Yardling jenny that had been accidentally left in its kiln overnight. And although the blaze only claimed a sideboard and an occasional table, it was still the talk of the town for many a year. But perhaps the most well-known events in which Yardling has featured historically, I suppose, were the famous frost fairs, which I'm sure people have heard of, on the Thames.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So every few years, a lot of times the Thames would freeze over.
So this is the Little Ice Age.
Yeah. So the Thames would freeze over, that people would hold these massive fairs on the Thames. So in 1677, the most famous one when Yardling is probably at his peak, incredibly, at least a quarter of the stalls were selling Yardling accoutrements. I mean, mainly woolen ear pads and knee sheaths due to the intense cold of the winters. As you said, the mini ice age. It's all changed now because of global warming, but that's another story, I suppose.
Right. Well, a number of bits of terminology again. I mean, you mentioned about the jennies, that one that caused this small fire known as the Great Fire.
I suppose it would be in
a local community like that. I actually don't remember anything about that from my childhood, but that's the way these things go. But we have jennies, we have porters, we have naps. Yep. How do those things relate to each other?
Well, essentially, you've got the porters are on the horizontal naps there. The horizontal nap is where you'd actually locate the porters. The jennies, and you've got floating jennies, static jennies, they would be used as an integral element with the porters to locate the threads. Now, the bifurcated threads wouldn't necessarily need jennies, but if you had jennies, then you could actually run them off, in a sense, twice as fast. The kilns were used to bring the jennies to the correct temperature. I mean, since Swanage, they're very rarely used now for sort of health reasons.
It's mind-boggling. It's very difficult to actually visualise this kind of thing. Yeah.
You've got the revolving porter as well, which is, if you can imagine, a conical pin, like a sort of a mushroom-shaped pin. That sits in the centre of the horizontal nap. And that was the problem, I suppose. When you go back to the vertical naps, that's why the thing fell to the ground and they just simply wouldn't work with that arrangement of porters.
As I say, very difficult to actually visualise. I want to play that folk song that we mentioned earlier on. Mm. They're called Yearns. I think, have I pronounced that correctly? A yearn?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is a Yardling, specifically Yardling folk song. Mm. So the one we're going to hear is called Yardling Was My First Love, written by a man named Daniel Fitzpatrick. So this is from around the 1880-1890 time. Mm. And the recording is on a wax cylinder from around that time. So the sound quality is really very poor. Mm. So we're going to hear it. But before that, would you mind just reading through the lyrics so that listeners can get a proper idea of what's being sung about?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we're lucky that we were written circa 1880, and it was actually written down because it's quite hard to pick it out. Yes. Okay, so I'll just read it out to you. In 20 years and 10, my bonny lass will cry. Don't hold me back, don't tie my hair, just sit me down in a yardless chair. And then the chorus goes, I've got my chawns, I've got my threads, I've got my whistling beads. All I need is a pretty young woman to bestow my yardling needs. So that's the chorus. Then we go back into the second verse. In 20 years and 10, my bonny lass will say, don't tell me lies, don't let me loan, just comb my hair with a yardler's comb. Then you've got the chorus followed by the last verse. In 40 years and 10, my bonny lass will sigh, don't turn away, don't lower your eye, just touch my tongue with a yardler's pie. And then after that, you've got the chorus again, the final chorus. So that's what you sort of got to try and listen out for in the recording.
Right, the Yardler's Pie again. I'm feeling hungry already. Okay, so we're going to listen to now The Yardling Was My First Love by Daniel Fitzpatrick from the 1880s. Well, as we said, difficult to hear, but it's not in bad condition, really, for such an old recording on a wax cylinder there. So do tell us about this song and perhaps the recording. What do we know about those?
Not a great deal. The date on the pin of the cylinder, these are the wax cylinders, they have a pin at the end, it's dated 1888. Really, all we know is that the other end of the pin, it says For Flory. Now,
who
Flory is, we really don't know.
Yeah. What about the whistling beads and Yandler's comb? Are these things that are generally in use?
Nowadays, again, because of this flood that I sort of referred to earlier, destroying some of the documents, the whistling beads now are only worn in a sort of a ceremonial fashion to dictate who's the elder of the group, if you like, of the community. Mm. And the combs, there's a link with the peaked hats. You have to have the hair combed a certain way. But other than that, they're not integral to the craft nowadays, no.
Now, one thing I noted when listening to this is that the song is actually in the Dorian mode. Obviously, as a musician, you know, I'm sensitive to this kind of thing.
Right.
Is that normal for these, or would they use other modes as well?
No, they did use other modes, but the Dorian mode tended to be the one that seemed to be the most basic form for these yearns.
Right. People not familiar with these modes, you can produce, say, the Dorian mode very easily. You just go to a piano, play all the white notes, and instead of playing, you know, the notes of C major by going C to C, you know, C, D, E, F, G, A, B, C, like that, you go D to D, and that will give you the Dorian mode. So interesting that so many of them are using that particular mode. What do we know about Daniel Fitzpatrick himself?
Not a lot. We know he was born in County Galway. He was a chairmaker by trade. But that's about it. We think that there is some evidence that it was his brother who was singing on the recording. But again, we don't really know.
Was that an Irish accent then that he had? Because it's a bit of an odd.
Yes, I know. Well, he was born in County Galway. His brother, we don't think he was born in County Galway. He was that, so that could well have been a northern accent that his brother was using. But I mean, I would suggest, if that's all right to say, if anybody or any of your listeners have got any more information, perhaps they could contact you, because it would be good to find out more.
Or contact you, because you're going to give us your email address, aren't you, at the end?
Yeah, sure.
And that song does get a mention in your book, Never Too Old to Sing the Yandling Blues, does it?
Thank you. Thank you for the plug, Julian.
No problem.
Yes. Yes, it does. No, I mean, that discovery of that recording was instrumental in getting the whole book off the ground.
Wow.
I mean, we've all heard of Terry Telford, Melvin Peach, people like that. But this was a very unusual and a very old recording that I talk about in great depth. I mean, Telford is more associated with the Devon scene, especially in the early 1900s. Peach tended to be more popular in northern seaside resorts like Scarborough, Whitby. So his fame didn't really extend down south. His best known yearn, and one I mentioned in the book, is I'm the Gayest Yandler in Wigan. Yes. I know.
Oh, dear.
Which was an ironic title as the central character, this young Yandler, new to the trade. He gets his thumbs caught in a revolving porter and has to give up the craft on the eve of his wedding. So, And now Mike Beaming has lots of old recordings of yearns from the 40s and 50s, so he was very helpful when it came to researching it all.
Yeah, you've told me that he's a great right-hand man, as it were, in this research business. Now, obviously, you're writing this book. It's been taking you quite a long time to write it, but I think you're saying that it's going to come out in the next few months, is it?
Yeah, that's the intention. I'm working on it now. It's going to the printers, I think, in May, June.
And it doesn't go beyond 1967 because there were no yearns, as far as we know, written after that year.
No. 1967 was the year of the Great Schism, which yarners talk about even now. And it's essentially because of the arguments for and against bifurcated chawns, they came to a head in 1967. And there was a huge amount of unrest,
right,
which is, you know, a very sad thing because this is a very close-knit community. So there was a lot of unrest, and simply no one was that interested in coming up with any new songs after that. And that is the position as it remains today. So there's a very definite sort of end point to the yearn.
That is amazing, isn't it? That something should be quite so precipitous as that.
Mm.
But of course, the Great Schism was helpful in some ways. Obviously, it did cause a lot of trouble. But looking back at it, it was helpful in an historical sense because it did open up information about all kinds of personalities in history, many very well-known personalities whose lives were impacted by Yandling. So could you tell us something about those characters and how Yandling affected them?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's going to be a bit of a list, but I can happily sort of take you through some of them. Most of them are mentioned, or a lot of them are mentioned in Collingwood's history. But just to give you a flavour, we go back to Samuel Pepys. Samuel Pepys was a keen advocate of the art. Now, his diary entry for 5th of May, 1665, he says, "For every man who yandles, minister or pauper alike, another will gladly take his place when he shall tire, which no doubt he shall. For yandling, if performed properly, is a skillful business requiring much presence of mind and agility of hand."
Wow.
D.H. Lawrence, although he wasn't a yandler himself, and indeed in later life he vehemently criticised the whole practice, he mentioned in one of his early essays, I've got it here, "I have never met a Cornish fisherman who does not say, with some pride, that yandling has made him what he is today." That was written in 1928. If you're talking about famous people, Churchill, Winston Churchill, was probably the most famous yandler.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. He would often turn to yandling in the War Office during the darkest days of the Second World War. And if you go there now, and I did go there, I've been there about sort of 5 or 6 years ago, you go down into the cabinet war rooms, which were in central London, and you've on his desk, everything's preserved as it was during the war. On his desk, you've still got several floating jennies.
Cool.
On his desk, yeah, which are exactly as he left them when he vacated the bunker at the end of the war. Shakespeare, couldn't be much more famous than that.
Indeed, this is fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about that, yeah.
Okay, so his last play, well, we think it's his last play. Authorship, obviously, is a bit of a bone of contention, isn't it? But at the end of his last play, 1611, The Tempest, now, he's only mentioned yandling once, and it's interesting that it's right at the end of his very last play. And this is said by the character of the boatswain. This is right at the end of the play. The play is about people being shipwrecked on an island, and the boatswain of the ship appears at the end. Sorry, it's a spoiler for you. And I think we have a clip of that, don't we?
We do indeed. You sent me a recording of a performance of The Tempest, which was at the Edward Alderton Theatre in Kent, here in the UK, which I think was from 2014, is that right?
Yes, I think it was, yeah.
And it's particularly interesting because they performed from the recovered version of the original text, which has the brief but fascinating reference to yandling spoken by the boatswain. So we'll hear it now. This is from Act 5, Scene 1 of Shakespeare's The Tempest.
"Give me your hands. Let grief and sorrow still embrace his heart, who doth not wish you joy."
"Be it so. Amen.
Oh, look, sir, look, sir. Here is more of us. I prophesy, if a gallows be on land, this fellow could not drown.
What is the news?"
"The best news is we've found our king and company. And the next... our ship, which but 3 hours since we gave out split, is as tightly yarned, old, and bravely rigged as when we first put out to sea."
Okay, so there you have it. It's fascinating to hear that. Now, and this is interesting that there is only one mention of it in Shakespeare's plays, because around the beginning of the 17th century, the whole practice of yandling was really on the up. There were even stage shows devoted to it, in which people would dress up in their finest clothes and perform mienes. I don't know if we mentioned mienes.
I'm going to ask you about mienes in a bit, yeah.
Sure, okay. So they would be performed on adjacent rooftops. They would also perform short, morally uplifting scenes in which love, friendship, marriage, child-rearing were all shown through the prism of yandling. There were also some people who took against the craft, notably Spencer Compton Cavendish, who was the 8th Duke of Devonshire, who... he was married in 1892, and he actually banned any yandlers from attending.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
How could anyone have such an objection to it?
I don't know, but what's interesting is he used his wedding speech to actually criticise them. He talked about them as being filthy wayfarers, salty old bootleggers. I mean, there are rumours that Wallis Simpson was very anti-yandling, and when she persuaded Edward VIII to abdicate, of course, that very famous case... There was a huge amount of ill feeling among the Windsors, the royal family, that Edward would be indoctrinated, if you like, in a tunic lifestyle.
Tunic?
Sorry, tunic. Tunic is it's a disparaging word for someone who is against yandling. So in the yandling community, to refer to somebody as a tunic would be, you know, to sort of ostracize them, if you like. But there's no evidence that Edward stopped his keen interest in the craft. There's no proof, but there are rumours that he tried to persuade President Nixon to take it up.
I know. Things could have turned out a bit differently if that had happened.
Yeah, I would have thought. I noticed in what you say there, although you mentioned a woman, when it comes to the actual business of doing yarndling, there's no mention of women, which I think is rather interesting. So perhaps we will listen once more to Dr. Chris Tavistock, because he has something to inform us about this particular question.
It's surprising, perhaps, that we don't have more descriptions of either skintering or actual yarndling from the early travelogues of England. I don't think it gets a mention at all in Defoe's tour through the whole island of Great Britain. There is a tantalising reference in Celia Fine's writings, later published as Through England on a Side Saddle. She refers to yarndling bands and clips. She was very interested in them. When she visited the Bastable family of High Dean, probably around 1695, I dare say she was interested. She was always a very curious woman, but interested because they would have been unfamiliar. You know, the secretiveness of the skinterers and yarndlers was a major problem for historians of this subject. And certainly, even at the time, for a woman, she would have found information very hard to obtain. You know, the yarndlers' guilds were quite unnecessarily secretive, though I suppose there was an essential protectionist rationale behind it. They regarded it as men's work and didn't want it to be diluted by a female labour force, which in their eyes, might seem to have devalued it. So, really, it was largely kept away from the eyes of women, and therefore, really, other than this, as I say, tiny reference from Celia Fine's, we have very little to go on in the way of, when it comes to the subject, women and yarndling, or the skintering either, for that matter.
But you do have an amusing historical anecdote about one woman yarndler in one of your books. I can't remember which one it is. Obviously, you sent me just a page from that book, and I'm sorry, I just can't remember which one. But do tell us something about that, because it had something to do with yarndling hair chaplets.
Yes. I think it's in my book, Looking Through Binoculars at Yarndling. And it's the story of Cissy Wainwright, who was to have been married to, I think his name was Bernard Argent, in around 1940. And she asked for her bridesmaids to wear the special yarndler's hair chaplets, and all painted in pink. Now, she was a keen supporter of yarndling, and her husband-to-be was the son of one of the principal yarndlers in Runcorn. So she has all these black chaplets painted pink, and they all look, you know, lovely and fine and everything. But unfortunately, it starts to rain, this being England. So quick as a flash, she pops into the local cheesemonger's and buys some cast malt, which is, I don't know if you know it, it's a very pink cheese, very pink in colour.
Yeah.
So, okay, so she, you know, smears this over the chaplets. So you can sort of picture that. The poor bridesmaids can't have been very happy, but this is the strange thing. The irony is that both the vicar and her future husband were both colourblind, so they didn't notice a thing.
Extraordinary.
Yeah.
And of course, there's not a lot taught these days about any of this in schools, which I know is something that does concern you, because you do a lot of talking in schools and colleges around the country. I mean, so I wanted to ask you what you think about that modern trend in education where, you know, school children are taught to perhaps empathise with things like yarndling from the past, but they're rarely taught any of the facts about it.
Well, I mean, you know, to be serious a bit, I think it's a very sad thing. I mean, Tony Blair, who was in government when this trend began, first started, he claims, if you read his autobiography, to be a great yarndler himself. But in fact, he allowed it to happen. The problem was that although it was on the school curriculum, because of the secrecy surrounding the craft, there was very little to educate children about. So you had a few nursery rhymes, basic facts about chawns, where they came from, and the rules of yarndling. You know, yarndling do's and don'ts, if you like, but not much else. So, I mean, empathy is a great thing. It's very important in this day and age. But when it comes to empathizing with someone and you have really no idea what that person believes or how he goes about his business, then you're not really in the business of education anymore.
No, and I guess you must be very disappointed that all talk about Mians, that was excluded, deliberately excluded on the grounds that knowledge about it could be potentially dangerous. Children might actually try to copy this. That must have been...
I know, yeah.
go on, tell us, you know, why this might have been a concern. Because, I mean, when you actually look at a photograph of a Mian, it looks like a handstand, but that's not really correct, is it?
No, I mean, I've sent you a photograph which I think you're going to use to illustrate this, aren't you?
I'll put it in the show notes, yeah.
Yeah, so the Mian only goes back to the 19th century. It's not a particularly old tradition, if you like. I think it was first mentioned in the, there's an 1850 travel book called A Trip to See Old Harry and His Wife by the Reverend Croftcock. That refers to a rock formation in, again, in Dorset. It's funny how it crops up all the time.
Indeed.
Now, the Victorians loved spectacle, and the Mian is thought to be, it's thought to be a visual representation or interpretation of the way that the Jenny and the revolving porter fit together on the horizontal nap. And it does indeed look exactly like a handstand performed on a rooftop. It was usually performed by the eldest son of the family in full regalia, so that would include the whistling beads. It was always conducted on rooftops, never barefoot. There is some evidence to support the theory. I don't know how true it is that it was used as a discreet form of communication between yardlers to warn them of impending bad weather. But certainly, if you look at the photograph, it's a wonderful spectacle. But you can see perhaps now why it's no longer encouraged on health and safety grounds.
Well, I suppose so. Yeah, it's a dangerous thing to copy. So we're going to hear from Dr. Chris Tavistock just once more, and he's going to give us some more information about Mians and why the historical record about them, such as it is perhaps not quite as accurate as we might have imagined.
Because Mians are such a spectacle, they have caught the eye of travellers, certainly in Victorian times, when you have the introduction of the railways and more widespread travel. You do then find reports in some of the monthly reviews referring to the interesting sight of yardlers performing their Mians, but they have given a slightly false impression that it was a particularly coastal activity. But I think this just reflects the popularity of seaside trips for the class of person who was likely to write for the periodicals. Yardling was going on by this time across most of England, and therefore one shouldn't be over-impressed by references to the performing of Mians in, you know, along the North Cornish coast, those new resorts. I think it's more that they were just more visible.
And as I said earlier, of course, you are in the business of education. You lecture very widely on this subject. But that hasn't always been the case, has it? Because you did actually take quite an extensive break from it several years ago.
Yeah, well, without, you know, going into too much detail, there was a family illness back in the late 80s forced me to drop out of the whole scene, really. But it had a good end to it. It was fine. Things improved. I was able to sort of bounce back and everything. But that also happened at a time I moved to Wolberswick in Suffolk. And as you say, in the introduction, I'd begun breeding these hairless cats. And so that took up a lot of my time as well. But in 1995, I think it was, I had the great honour of becoming president of the Ancient Order of Yardlers for the town. And that sort of put me back on the map, and it made me again part of the community. That got me back into the whole yardling lifestyle once again. And to be honest, I've never looked back.
Wonderful. And you do a lot of this educational work now. How much time do you spend on that these days?
I spend at the moment about 3 or 4 days a week travelling around, teaching, educating children and adults. I do adult education courses as well. And the other time I spent in researching and writing, really.
And writing, but it's
very satisfying.
Indeed. Well, thank you ever so much for spending this time telling us about it. And you do have a web page. I know that you're going to extend that website at a certain point. Could you direct us towards that?
Yeah, I think it's going to be in your show notes, but certainly it's www.edwardalderton, that's all one word, .org/yardling.htm.
Excellent. And that will take people to a place where they can find out even more historical background to this subject.
Yeah.
And I know that you said before we began this interview that you'd like to share with people your email address in case people want to ask further questions about it, which I know you're very keen for people to do. So could you tell us that email address? Again, I will put it in the show notes, but it's good if people have an oral version of it as well.
Yeah, sure. It's buckeridge1961@gmail.com.
Okay. Do you want to spell that out?
BUCKERIDGE 1961@gmail.com. So, yeah, I mean, you know, really appreciate the chance to have a chat to you about this. And if listeners do want to contact me, that would be great.
Well, thank you ever so much, Campbell Adams, for coming on The Mind Renewed to talk about Yandling. I've certainly learnt a great deal myself this day, and I'm quite sure many people probably have heard about Yandling for the first time this very day on this show. So thank you ever so much for coming on and sharing with us all your experience and knowledge about this very interesting subject.
You're welcome, Julian. Thank you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Campbell Adams, and don't forget that Campbell can indeed be reached by email if any of you would like to ask him questions about what he had to say today. So let me just give that email address again. That's buckeridge1961@gmail.com, buckeridge1961@gmail.com, and he would, as he said, be very pleased to hear from listeners. And let me add, do go and check out the show notes for today's programme, because there's quite a lot of extra information there about Yandling and related historical matters, including photographs, recordings, and of course links to documentation. I always try to give as much information as I can in the show notes, but there's even more than usual this time, and you can find those notes simply via a link on today's podcast page at TMR. Next week and the week after, I'm not planning to do any podcasts because it's the Easter break, although we've got a big christening party to organise during that time, so I'm not quite sure how much of a break it's going to be, but nevertheless, it is Easter. But you know me, I might possibly put out a guest episode or something during that time, but we'll see what happens. So after Easter, we'll be talking to Frank Johnson, who writes for Chris White's website Ancient Aliens Debunked, and of course Frank has joined us a couple of times in the past as part of the Nephilim Boys shows that we've had here on New Year's Eve. And he'll be coming on to talk about, you've guessed it, the Ancient Aliens TV series and the whole Ancient Aliens phenomenon. Then in the weeks that follow, we'll be speaking to Dr. Robert J. Marks II, Distinguished Professor of Engineering at Baylor University, and we'll be talking about his forthcoming book, Introduction to Evolutionary Informatics, which he has co-authored with the mathematician and philosopher William Dembski and the software engineer Winston Ewart. And the book applies advances in information theory to current models of evolution to assess the case for intelligent design in nature. At some point thereafter, we shall welcome Graham from the excellent Five Red Pairs YouTube channel for a discussion on flat earth theory, or to be more precise, it'll be a conversation on his experience of interacting with people who are inclined towards such ideas and how he goes about arguing against these false arguments through using logic, observation, and geometry. We'll be speaking to C.R. Hiker, who is author of the book Crossroads, who will join us to share his experience of an interrail journey of evangelism across 9 European countries. And then I very much hope that we'll be speaking to Dr. Graham McQueen again, who's kindly agreed to join us to talk about the subject War as a System. That's not quite finalized yet, but I do hope that is going to happen in the weeks to come. So that's it for now, but just before I close, if you value what I do here at The Mind Renewed in all its variety of subject matters, some serious and some, well, perhaps not quite so serious, then please do give the show a positive comment and rating on iTunes or any other podcast media that you happen to use. I don't often make this request because I know it can be irritating when people ask this kind of thing all the time, so I limit myself and only ask occasionally. Well, this is just such an occasion, so please do consider helping TMR in that way, and helping me, because of course it's always a boost to the morale when you see something like that happen. And also please help to spread the word about TMR in any way that you can. So that's essentially it for today. As I say, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Much more to come after Easter. I wish you a very pleasant time over that same Easter period. You have been listening to me, Julian Charles, of themindrenewed.com, and I very much look forward to speaking to you again in the near future.